hadn't been today, it would have been at some other point. I would have caught up with you, and we would have gotten together and talked. Very few authors have escaped me over the past 15 or 20 years. Mystery writers and mainstream and science fiction, I do them all. And I'm just a book fanatic.
Good.
And in fact, I published a book last year that was also a mystery, but it was not nominated.
What was that?
It's called The H.L. Mencken Murder Case. It was published by Joan Kahn.
Yeah, no, I knew it. This morning when your name came over and Ivan gave me your name, I said to my wife, I've seen this name someplace before, and that's where I saw it. I saw it in the book, right.
Well, it was a very modest first effort, and so I'm completely an amateur compared to you. You've written how many books now?
27, something like that. That includes nonfiction, textbooks, a little bit of everything. I think it's 20 novels.
20 novels?
Yeah, it's 14 in the one series, 5 in this series. That's 19. Actually, it's 21 novels.
Well, writing novels.
A lot of short stories.
That's a pretty easy thing to do, though.
Movies, too.
It's a pretty easy thing to do, just knock out a novel.
It's not a pretty easy thing to do. It's a hard thing to do.
I know.
It's an awfully hard thing to do.
What made you want to pursue this arduous task as a writer?
Well, I've wanted to be a writer since I was about 14 years old. I started writing when I was 14. I don't think I pursued it, you know, as a serious avocation until I was well into my 30s.
Are you a Chicagoan?
Yeah, I was born in Chicago. I've lived my life in Chicago, with the exception of 1 year in Ann Arbor, Michigan, when I was at the University of Michigan, and 2 years in the Army. Other than that, I'm from Chicago.
Do you consider Michigan your alma mater?
No, I didn't even go to Michigan. I have a bachelor's degree in journalism from the University of Illinois, a master's degree in English literature from Illinois, and my PhD, my doctorate, is in speech from Northwestern University, where I teach.
Uh-huh. Did you grow up in a literary household?
Not at all. Neither of my parents finished high school. And my sister never finished. My sister did finish high school, that's true. None of my grandparents did. But I do have a number of relatives, cousins primarily, who have gone all the way through the PhD. One of my cousins is a provost at Temple.
Well, there must have been something in your formative years that made you want to look into this intellectual world.
Actually, no, it came about rather strangely. I'd always had a kind of basic interest in reading, in popular genre literature. I never thought much about initially about writing when I was a child, but I began to devour books, mostly popular books. I would devour anything. I'm not sure where that impulse came. But and one day I could read Alice in Wonderland and the latest Mickey Spillane book on the same day and have no problem reconciling these two. I think that's been a kind of strength of mine ever since. I don't draw the kinds of qualitative distinctions that people often do, and part of that might be the strength of my background, not having anyone tell me what I should and should not read. I just read it eclectically, and I think my work sometimes shows that eclecticism, including the book that one of the books we're going to be talking about. It was, and from, as I said, from the time I was about 14 years old, I knew I wanted to be a writer. And it is strange. There was nobody in my family who'd ever gone into writing, done any writing at all. I just knew it. In fact, I was rather steered away from it, with the idea that I couldn't make a living doing that. I shouldn't go into journalism, even though I went to go into journalism school. But I didn't like anything else. It was really what I wanted to do. And I pursued it. I didn't have any great success as a writer. I did it professionally. You worked for United Press before I went in the Army, after I got out of school. Various jobs, local newspapers. I actually went to some in public relations writing for universities, went to a number of universities as a public relations writer, University of Chicago, University of Illinois, and University of Michigan. I kept writing. I was writing novels. I was writing short stories with sort of limited success. I had a short story published in New Mexico Quarterly. I had a series of short stories published in the Old Man from U.N.C.L.E. magazine, which were pop stories. I had a play produced in New York, one performance, and this is back in the late 60s, and then on CBS television in the Repertoire Workshop series back in the late 60s. But I didn't have any real success until my first novel was published. I'd written 5 novels before my first novel was published, and I'd actually had 2 nonfiction books published by the time my first novel was published.
Tell me about that first novel.
First novel published, because there are 5 that weren't published. I think it's interesting. I the first five novels I did, which I'll just mention briefly to get to this one, weren't very, nobody really wanted them. I couldn't get an agent for them. They were highly, I think, pretentious. Now, I wanted recognition in writing those novels. I really achieved my first success by forgetting about that and just writing a book for myself that I really enjoyed writing for myself. Even after my agent had told me, I had an agent by that time for nonfiction, had told me not to write any more fiction. Just give it up. And I was...
That's a presumptuous
no, he was right.
Advice.
No, he was right. The five books that I had done were really awful. And had I continued to write books like that, no one would have wanted them. And I think you're quite right. But as soon as I wrote this book and I sent it to him, he said, I don't know what happened, but I like it, and we'll proceed with it. And I think he was right. And I think that the key to that was that I wasn't writing for the admiration of other people. I was writing to please myself. And it worked. That was Bullet for a Star, the first book in my Toby Peters series. I still have the other five books, and one of them, actually, from time to time, I go back to it, try to rewrite and get it, I think, in a form that I find more acceptable, with the possibility of maybe getting it published. But the other four, I have no desire to see published.
Well, you have two major series characters. Tell me about Toby Peters.
Yeah, Toby Peters is my first successful series. I've done 14 in them now.
14?
In the series, right.
And you never get bored.
Oh, no, no, no. I keep coming up with ideas, and I'll tell you about the idea for the next one. Basically, Toby Peters is a... The series began chronologically in 1939, and it's now moved up to 1942. They take place basically in and around Los Angeles, not exclusively, but basically in and around Los Angeles, and my detective gets involved with historical characters as clients. And each one has a different client character, and each one tends to have a kind of popular literary character, too, who is involved in the crime. So it's usually a kind of duality. I've had books, and I like to have strange juxtapositions of characters in that. One of my books, Never Cross a Vampire, the two clients were Bela Lugosi and William Faulkner. And I thought that I really enjoyed doing things like that.
I'm glad you didn't hit upon H.L. Mencken.
Not yet. No, I didn't. Dashiell Hammett was a character in my most recent book, which just came out from Mysterious Press, Buried Caesars. Mm-hmm. The two characters are General Douglas MacArthur and Dashiell Hammett. I like strange juxtapositions of people who could have met but probably never did, and bringing them together in historical context. So that series really plays on both my interest in film. I'm a professor of film at Northwestern University. And my love of the genre, of the popular detective story.
And what kind, tell me about Toby Peters. What is he like?
What is he, yeah. In my favorite author is Raymond Chandler. I really love Raymond Chandler. I don't think I would have liked him as a human being, but as a writer, I really like him. One of the things I wasn't particularly pleased about in Chandler's writing about Philip Marlowe, is that there is a slight air of pretension about Philip Marlowe. He's the chess player, there's even a sense of intellectuality about Marlowe, which I think is really Chandler himself projecting a bit on the character. Toby Peters has no pretensions at all. He's not stupid, but he's basically a plotter. He's a good-willed plotter, a good-natured plotter who loves what he's doing. And he plays off of other people. I think he has a kind of wit that the hard-boiled detective is known for in their first-person novels. But I don't think there's that aura of pretension, of superiority exists in the character. Quite the contrary. I mean, he doesn't understand what's going on around him, whereas most detectives seem to have this wonderful insight. John D. MacDonald's character, in fact, had this immense philosophical insight. I'm not even describing it qualitatively, but they had this sense of what is the world like and what does it mean to me. Toby has no sense of what the world is like. All he lives for is this very, very moment and has this wonderful joy of the moment. He has no money. He's always completely broke. He lives in a rundown rooming house, and when his best friend next door is 3 feet tall Swiss translator and a down-and-out dentist who he shares an office with. He actually has his office is in a closet of a dentist who's himself about the lowest rung of dentistry one can imagine. So he's really, if you're looking for down-and-out detectives, Toby is down-and-out. And he's surrounded by various characters who come to play an important role in the series.
Oh, it sounds like a wonderful series. And
it's basically funny. It's fun, basically. It's fun. It's full of nostalgia, of period, and full of humor, basically, I think. And the reviews tend to bear that out. My readers tend to bear out.
You must keep a lot of research material, all the old Life magazines. And
yes, people, and people send them to me. I listen to, regularly listen to radio shows from that period. I have several sources. And I decide the period in which that particular book will be set. And I actually listen to the radio shows from that week. Sometimes I incorporate what happens in the show. Sometimes I don't, even from the news broadcast. And I read the Los Angeles Times for that whole week, issue by issue, page by page, much more carefully than people read them when they initially came out. And they're just full of wonderful material. You find marvelous things in the middle of this that I incorporate. And sometimes people find it hard to believe. I found I was doing research last year on a book that came out, I think came out last year. I came across the Walter Cronkite's first byline. And it was a battle, one of the battles of, battle, not the Battle of Midway.
Mostly with UP then, huh?
Yeah. And I was just amazed that there's Walter Cronkite's byline back in 42, early 1942. And I made a reference to it in the book. And, you know, that my detective obviously doesn't know who Walter Cronkite is, but he's reading this article about something that's of interest to him by Cronkite. And just all kinds of wonderful little things come. I love doing the research on that book. I love reading the biographies of the stars or the people who I deal with. They're not all movie stars. I've done books in which the central character, outside of my detective and the people who operate with him, I've done one on Eleanor Roosevelt, Howard Hughes, one of my most popular ones is on Joe Lewis. And the most recent one, I did one on Einstein, set primarily in Princeton, New Jersey. And the most recent one deals with Douglas MacArthur, who's always been a favorite character of mine. I wanted to put in fiction and finally did.
Well, speaking of research, apparently you have had to do quite a bit of research because you're the character who won you the Oscar before
Edgar,
Rostikoff.
The Edgar.
I'm sorry. I knew that. Edgar, of course.
Yeah.
He is, Rostikoff is a Soviet police inspector, and these books are set in the Soviet Union.
Yes.
But most of us just look at the Soviet Union as kind of a cold, gray mass of land and with very little identity.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how did you go about doing your research for this?
It's not easy. It's not easy. There are a number of ways of doing research. And I'll come back to something you just mentioned, which I think is particularly important and particularly telling, and that's the kind of mythos of the Soviet Union, just as there's a mythos about the United States. Somebody like Kafka can write a book called America without ever really knowing what America is and have this kind of strange distortion of America and yet have it be America. I think a little bit of that exists in my my novels, but they do take an enormous amount of research, enormous amount of reading. I devour travel books. I devour histories. I devour personal accounts of people, particularly Americans, and there are a lot of books by Americans who've lived in the Soviet Union, picture books, timetables. I devour timetables, just whatever data I can get. Equally important is interviews with people. I'm fortunate enough now to be at Northwestern University, which is a wonderful Slavic languages department, full of people who visit the Soviet Union regularly. I mean, people who speak Russian and maybe spend 2-3 months a year there. And just supply me with, not if they don't have the information, finding people who will. Including, I've interviewed extensively 2 former KGB agents who've supplied me wonderful information. Former reporter for Pravda, who gave me detailed descriptions of Petrovka, which is the central police building in Moscow. I mean, he knew it inside out from having been in it and gave me wonderful details about that. So it takes a lot of work. Just having a character go down the street requires enormous research.
Yeah, that's because if you are completely wrong...
Can't be wrong.
No, you can't, because the whole book will lose credibility.
Right. The credibility is pyramided from the bottom up. If I make one mistake, I lose it. One historical mistake, one mistake of place, I've lost my audience. I recognize that, and that's a very important part of any kind of basic research. If I don't know it, don't put it in. But if I'm going to put it in, it's got to be right.
Or you can make it hazy or fudge it somehow.
You can, but you can't do that too often. It has to have that texture, that specificity. You don't have to know everything, but when you do say something, it must be right, and there must be enough of that specificity so that the reader really believes in my ability of place, and that my characters are in those places and know those places. Yeah, it's a juggling job.
I just like novels where they refer to a major eastern city, but it's not defined. Yeah. It could be almost any city. I like the feeling of place. I like the knowing that there are streets named for what the streets are really are, and that there mm-hmm. are buildings that exist and monuments and things like that, because I can see it. Because mm-hmm. I've been around all through the East a lot, and I can see these cities. And just to have sort of a mythic city there, it's like a city rising from the mist. It's not clear at all.
I think that's generally true. I think there are a few exceptions. I think Ed McBain's 87th Precincts are a strange exception to that, in which he creates a city, which is a kind of doppelganger of New York. And I think that works reasonably.
Those are set in Queens somehow.
No. They're set in a mythical city called Isola.
I know it, but I see it Queens.
Oh, it's Manhattan. I mean, the basic center is obviously a strange distortion of Manhattan. There's a wonderful book about that by a man named George Duff, which is actually about the 87th novels and the strange geography of them. It's a brilliant book. But that's an exception. I think you're basically right. I think people are generally better off, writers are generally better off deciding where they're going to set their book and then making that place as concrete, as tangible as possible, even if their readers will never visit, even if it's Cleveland, whatever it is, and make it as real. And actually, there are two series in Cleveland now, which I think are quite good.
Well, tell me about Inspector Rostikoff.
Oh, I'd love to. there have been five.
He's been very good to you.
Oh, he's been wonderful to me. I've had two Edgar nominations, and I won the Edgar for Best Book this year because of one of the Rostikoff books. Rostikoff and the two other inspectors that he works with, who work under him, really came out of another book I was going to write. I was going to write a multi-generational novel, a massive, sprawling historical novel beginning...
I thought somebody did that already.
About the Soviet, about Russians?
No, a massive historical generational book.
No, but this one...
It seems to me I read one somewhere.
No, there have been a few of them, but that may be the problem. That may have been the problem. But mine really was going to deal with some kind of mythical roots of my own family, which is Russian. And I actually wrote it. I wrote 100 pages of this and did an outline for the book, and nobody much wanted it. I did enormous research. It really begins in the in the 1880s, and it's full of, I think it's wonderful historical detail. Couldn't find anybody who wanted to do a book like that. I had done this research, and at that point I wanted to delve into what my sense was of the Soviet character. It was something in me that had to be done. So I did do the first Rostikoff. I had to go back and do more research, find people, find resources. It took a long time, and I finally completed it. And I liked it very much. First one was called Death of a Dissident. And I tried to do a couple of things in it, which I've continued to do in the series, and I think helped make the series, I think, reasonably successful. It probably goes all the way back to what I told you about my child and the kind of eclecticism. I think the voice, when you read the book, I think you'll find that the voice sounds authentic, but it's literary authentic. I try to write the books in a kind of just before the turn of the century Russian vernacular. I want it to sound like Gogol or Dostoevsky. I don't want it to sound like contemporary Russian. Because if you read a contemporary Russian novel, they don't sound like mine. Mine sound like what Americans think Russians write like. But it's not what Russians write like. It's what Russians wrote like the great Russian writers wrote like. And in each book, I really try to capture that voice. But at the same time, everything that happens in the book is very contemporary. And it's whatever is happening today. The crimes that are involved are very political, and they're very much involved in changing attitudes within the Soviet Union, and it's very much influenced by the evolution of the genre itself. When I received the award yesterday, I thanked four primary writers of police procedural stories, in addition to Dostoevsky and Gogol, who are extremely important to me in terms of style. I also acknowledged the credit to Hilary Waugh, who basically started the modern procedural story, to Georges Simenon, who McGray is a very, very important influence on Rostikoff, and I don't hide that. I'm very pleased with that. George Gideon, the John Creasy series, Gideon of Scotland Yard, and finally, and most important, the 87th Precinct novels, which I've already forced into the conversation by Ed McBain, Evan Hunter.
Well, what kind of guy is Rostikoff?
What kind of guy is he? Mm-hmm.
What kind of person? What kind of man is he?
Raznikov is in his mid-50s, slightly, maybe a tiny bit overweight. He has a bad left leg. He was injured as a boy in the Battle of Rostov. He's a soldier, a boy soldier during World War II. And the pain, he suffers quite a bit of agony from that. He's a rather calm individual who is constantly caught in the pressures of the constant pressures of the Soviet Union. He's caught politically, he's caught socially. His wife is Jewish and wants to get out, and this prevents him from promotion, keeps him from promotion. And he's kind of in this enormously tense situation. And yet he himself is a remarkably tranquil man, partly because he finds ways to cope. He's very accepting, and he really enjoys, lives for his job. For example, one of the things that he does is he's a weightlifter. He doesn't do it, you know, to compete. Actually, in one book, he winds up accidentally competing in a competition, but as a kind of meditation. He has a series of things that he does as a meditation. One of his favorite things is reading Ed McBain novels, which he gets smuggled into the country. And the other thing he loves doing, he loves plumbing. And if he waxes philosophically about anything, it is plumbing, because it's the one control that one... It's a control that he feels he has. He can actually repair things. So, and in the Soviet Union, it's very difficult to see the fruits of your labor, particularly if you're in any kind of bureaucratic job, even a procedural job like his. So he likes to get plumbing books, and he helps the neighbors fix their toilets.
There's probably a lot of plumbing that needs to be fixed.
A lot of plumbing, because it's so difficult to get anybody to come and fix anything. And he gets enormous satisfaction outside of his job, in his family, his wife, and his son who's in the army. And he tends to see the people who work under him as a kind of surrogate family, an extended family. His method primarily is, again, it's similar, somewhat similar to McGray's, but not quite the same. He loves talking to people. Action comes because it's forced upon him, not because he feels he should initiate action. He would rather talk about people. And he has enormous empathy for anybody who is not immediately violent. And in some of the cases, he even has empathy for people who turn out to be very violent. So he tends to be a very paternal figure, I think. And a lot of people recognize that within him. He is named for Dostoevsky's, the inspector in Crime and Punishment, who's Porfiry Petrovich, as is my detective, Porfiry Petrovich Raznikov.
Isn't it interesting? Do you suppose that the first private detective who really had an identity was Holmes? And since that time, mystery writers, such as yourself and others, from Agatha Christie on... down on up, have tried to come up with interesting characters to carry the mystery through.
Yeah, I that's a good point. I think the difference, well, some of them were private. You're right, Sherlock Holmes, private detective.
But Poe and Maupassant's Dupin weren't very, I can't remember the
Dupin
people.
Really. Is Poe's. And he's a very arrogant. Poe's detective is very, very
arrogant. It doesn't stand out, though.
No, it doesn't particularly stand out. I think there's a reason for it. My proposal would be one of the reasons for the reemergence of the mystery story over perhaps the last decade, and the mystery story is doing very, very well now after a period in which it seemed to be semi-moribund dead. But as I said, about the last decade, it's reemerged strongly. And I think one of the reasons is the recognition of the importance of character. And I think before that, there were plenty of people before that, I can name a lot, including Chandler, who may or may not have recognized, Chandler recognized it, that the importance, the central driving force of any novel that brings people to the novel is the voice of the writer and the empathy with character.
Well, when you think of a writer today, you... think of the character that goes with the writer.
That's right. You think of the character. That's right. The very
Leo
point
Hammett,
you made.
You think of Sam Spade.
The very point that you made. Right. That's exactly right. And you forget all of the other people who were contemporaries of Dashiell Hammett because they were so concerned with working out those plots and getting people somewhere. And really, that while that's nice, and I think any writer should have the plot worked out and it should make sense and it should proceed accordingly and people should be able to follow it, people will accept horrible things in plot if they really love those characters. And I think that's an important change. And I think the recognition, people don't tend to remember what the heck happened in the Holmes stories, but they remember Holmes and Watson. And occasionally they remember another character, the redheaded man, or somebody else from the stories, but not the stories themselves. I mean, I remember the stories vividly, every one of them. But it's really the character that matters now, and a recognition of that.
Why do you think mysteries appeal to such an intellectual audience? I am sure there's a cross-section of people who read
sure
mysteries.
There is.
There's no doubt about that. But the very fact that I know of many people who teach in colleges and people who have been mentors to me, and they admit they just love mysteries. They can't put them down. They're on waiting lists at the library.
Yes.
They buy paperbacks. They just love it. And you would think that they would not be the sort of person who would read a mystery, but they do.
I think, something that has changed is I think mysteries, to appeal to that kind of audience, have to be literate. The people you're talking about probably are not reading pulp literature. They're probably reading what I would consider to be mainstream, and a very broad expanse of mainstream and very high quality mysteries. But mysteries and nonsense are no different from any other novels. The quality of writing, I think, is on a par for mysteries and other generic forms. And obviously, I have a prejudice. I tend to think sometimes that mysteries are better written by people who have more experience writing them. But that's a prejudice. I admit the prejudice. I think there are a couple of other things about mysteries. One is people have tended, intellectuals or non-intellectuals, have tended to miss, I think, the well-made story. You get both character and you get beginning, middle, and conclusion. You get a world in which questions are asked, a lot of questions are usually asked in a mystery novel, and the questions are all answered. You get a world restored. Mm. And you live in a world which is never restored and always in flux, and you're never sure of it. And a vast majority, till recently, of intellectual literature has been enigmatic, mirroring life. Even if it's surreal, it mimics, mirrors life. And I think people, while they may read it, are not always satisfied by that. They don't always want to read books that are enigmatic, and
it's disquieting in a way, whereas the mystery is kind of reassuring because everything is settled at the end. Everything is
absolutely. No matter how many murders there are, no matter how grisly they are, things are settled. Even if the settlement includes the killer is still loose, you know who the killer is, you know what your world's like, you know where your people are, and I think that's very reassuring. It's always been for me.
Well, from a writer's standpoint, it would seem to me that a mystery is easier to sell. That Minkin book that I wrote last year.
Yes.
Bought by the first publisher who saw it, and I have another book that's not a mystery. It's kind of a mainstream book. It's been turned down like 8 or 9 times, and it just leads me to think that there's much more of a market for a mystery than a mainstream novel.
There's a catch to this, although I think you're right. There's more of a market. The problem is, to a great extent, it is a genre market, and it's very difficult to write a mystery that will break through to big sales and a wide audience. But it's a little easier, I think you're right, to get that mystery published within that more narrow spectrum. And I'd love to break through and,
Well,
There's less resistance.
Your own, as your own description, your historical novel, that met with resistance.
Enormous resistance. Yeah. And it's not the only one. I've done several other novels, proposals and 100 pages of text, and people have turned
Rosnikoff. Give me another Rosnikoff, and we'll take him.
Oh, yeah, I can't write them fast enough for publishers. They'd be happy to have me turn out more of those, I'm sure.
Well, Stuart Kaminsky, to kind of wrap things up, you teach film at Northwestern. How do you reconcile your work as a professor with all the writing you're doing?
It's not so much a matter of reconciliation as finding the time to do them both. I think they're compatible. I have also done an increasing amount of film work, scripting. I think they're compatible, and I think the writing of the novel actually stimulates and is stimulated by my sense of the visual. I think my novels tend to be very visual. I think teaching is also very important, the feedback, the dealing with people. For me, I find it difficult to respond to writing in a kind of solitary way. And I have a lot of friends who are writers, who are basically writers, and go up to their room, and they write, and they really like to do that. To a great extent, I need the feedback. I need the intellectual stimulation. Students give that to me. Colleagues give that to me. The challenge of students, which is sometimes difficult to take, actually keeps me moving. The difficulty is that it's time-consuming. And finding time is the most difficult part of my writing.
Well, it's probably a good feeling for you to be in a in a community, have a sense of community, whereas many writers are alone.
Or isolated. Yeah. That's right. And I do think that sense of community, particularly a university atmosphere, is important. An increasing number of academics are writing novels and are writing mystery novels, and I think doing quite nicely.
How is this all going over with your peers and your bosses?
I've been doing this for quite a while, since the early to mid-70s.
I mean, they don't call you in and say, Kaminsky, when are you going to turn in an academic paper?
Well, I do that, too. I do a lot of that, too. I write textbooks. I've done a number of textbooks. I did one last year. But I'm in a department of radio, television, and film in a school of speech, a performance school, and it's very much supported. It's very much supported. It is part of what I do. It's part of what I teach. So I have no complaint, and nor has the university at which I teach had any complaint. They've been extremely supportive. And, of course, this makes me highly visible. And that
something
visibility
tells me
is important.
Your readers are not exactly complaining either.
No. I very seldom get a complaint.
Well, I want to congratulate you for winning that. That's Edgar. That's a terrific honor for you. And I know it's deserved. I know you have a lot of things to do. You're going to do a book signing in about 25 minutes around
right.
the corner, practically.
So right.
It's not far. But, again, Stuart, congratulations.
Thank you, Dan.